Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
It's been vaccination distribution craziness. And we're going to start with an article that was in the, I believe, the LA Times, talking about the state's electronic approach to distributing vaccine and why we love to hate the whoever it is that the state is buying its software from. Now, we experienced a little bit of problem, a little bit, I'm being nice, back when they were trying to do contact tracing and the state website was simply not able to accept all of the contacts that were being traced. Well, they got that one straightened out, but it is a time-consuming process and it's consumed a lot of time and possibly diverted focus from, you know, a plan that might have undergone a little critical commentary period. That would have been really nice. There certainly was time for it if we'd started back in October. But c'est la vie. Anyway, here's where we stand. The online software system, which the base one is called PrepMod, is a vaccine management tool that's supposed to coordinate wait lists and inventory. And providers are not being able to register to get vaccines. This is everyone from public clinics to nursing home operators. In LA County, the vaccine waitlist registry and access to vaccine registration has gone sideways. A lot of nursing homes have had problem. Now, doctors are supposed to go through a series of steps. They were described to me as a series of simple steps. They have not been simple. And I won't, you know, play my little violin here. It's not a pity party, but it's been frustrating. I'll just leave it at that. The registration site got so many complaints, this COVID-ready registration site, that they decided to fix it. Because people weren't finding that they couldn't sign up, they couldn't access the educational modules they needed in order to be able to register to receive vaccine. And most facilities were finding it that they had a big delay, even if they were already registered and had punched all the dials, which is probably why we haven't distributed a little more than a quarter of the vaccines that we've received. The state of California really didn't want to talk about this, but they did acknowledge they'd received complaints from some local health departments. I guess probably all of them, at least the ones who could figure out how to complain. Monday morning, I was greeted by a new page on the website that I tried so hard to sign on before saying, oops, we're sorry, we're going to a new platform. Oh, we'll get back to you in a week or so. Well, that was... Here we are, waiting for that new platform to work. It's, at the moment, vaporware and not currently accessible. And I think we're all going to be beta testers on this, at least if you're trying to get vaccine. Folks, I try to be positive, but I have to acknowledge I'm very frustrated, and I feel like I'm trapped in a Kafka-esque novel with all the usual bureaucratic gotchas. You know, I'll get email from 5 or 6 different email sites. Some of them go to spam. I don't know what they're called, so I don't know how to find them. And that's just one example of the frustration. And then if all this wasn't enough, not being able to register to get a vaccine, not being able to register to distribute them, we now have something else. From yesterday, Santa Clara supervisors received reports from all over the county that residents received texts telling them to sign up for COVID-19 vaccinations, but they weren't in the current vaccination phase 1 period. They received a text message that said, quote, local medical providers had extra COVID-19 vaccines and to register for an appointment. Well, obviously this was phishing. And they haven't been able to figure out where those texts came from. And it was a great way to get people's personal information. So if you get a text message, you probably want to check that that's what's supposed to happen by going to the California Public Health Department and seeing if you find anything about text messages. In general, text messages are easy to spoof and use for phishing. You really only want to fill in stuff that comes from a trusted source, and that means looking carefully at the extension. Typically, if you take the @ at the end of that email and you just copy that and drop it into your browser, if it's legit, you're going to get a whole bunch of California Department of Public Health websites popping up, and that will show you that you have a legitimate extension. Unfortunately, all of these state agencies have a bunch of different extensions. It can't just be logical. You know, if it has a .org instead of a .gov, it could be fake. Bottom line is, we're all going to have to be really vigilant about our personal information because we're scared. And that's when phishing happens, okay? Phishing happens when you're scared and preoccupied. It's a classic strategy in internet scams that you wait until back in the day when we all went home at 5 at least, you wait until late in the afternoon or very early in the morning when people are trying to whip through a ton of email. Your message contains something that is emotionally upsetting or generates an adrenaline rush, which, by the way, drops us about 50 IQ points, which is why you always want to go cool off before you make any decisions. And ultimately, what we end up with is a situation where scammers can mess with us. First of all, I cannot understand why someone would want to sabotage people's... Well, actually, I take it back. If people don't trust the process, they won't get vaccinated. And somehow that's going to make somebody who doesn't believe in vaccination feel better or somehow be reinforced. I don't understand this. And if somebody else understands it and wants to explain to me the mentality, I'd love to hear it. Now, enough ranting. I've got some good news, at least for Santa Cruz County. For those of you who are over 75 and who have been to anyone who's been to Palo Alto Medical Foundation in the last 2 years for any clinical visit, they consider you an established patient. And so when your demographic group comes up for vaccine, you will be invited to come for vaccination. But the important thing to understand is that groups like Kaiser and Palo Alto Medical Foundation, Dignity, these are multi-county entities. So they are not having to work through the state of California at all to get vaccine. They are getting their shipments directly from the federal government. And you know what? The pass-through appears to be perhaps working a little bit better in those multi-county entities. I just want to say that the plan has stalled at the state level, and we're hoping that we'll start to see improvement. But the registration process for small solo practices like mine is sufficiently complex that I really don't know what's going to happen. I hope that they will get it straightened out or find a way around it. I know that the people at the local public health department are very dedicated and are working as hard as they can to figure out something. And I keep hoping that Monday, Newsom is going to loosen up these rules, because tight protocols for access are creating a real problem. The complex hierarchical protocol with the phase 1A, tier 1, tier 2, tier 3, that's kind of disappearing as reality sets in to the state public health department and the CDC and their elaborate plans, which look great on paper. But as I said, I think last week, no plan survives the first shot. That's a quote from Napoleon. One last bit before we leave the vaccinations. If you are a medical office staff, there is a mass vaccination plan, and that includes doctors in private practice, doctors who have who are specialists who have not received vaccines through the hospital systems, you will be getting an invitation to a mass vaccination event, and your staff, particularly anyone who is seeing the public, who works at your office, will be eligible. So let's take a deep breath and realize this process is going to roll out slowly. If you are 75 years or older, it's very likely you'll be hearing from one of these max vaccination clinics or through some other source within the next 30 days. So please hang in there. I have faith that this is a blip and they're going to get it together and they're going to make it work. So let's not be too critical, although I must say it's always very frustrating when the car won't start and you've got to get somewhere in a hurry. Let's go to our first email, and that's from Gary in San Jose. Dear Dr. Don, I have a COVID question for me and one for my wife. I have allergies. Avocado, if eaten, causes my throat to itch and swell. Banana make me a bit wheezy. Latex causes skin irritation, plus the common pollen, cat fragrance, and some soap sensitivities. I also had a slight reaction to my last flu shot 12 years ago in the form of facial edema. So, folks, that's called angioedema when your face swells. Anaphylaxis, which is a dangerous form of allergic reaction. Continuing Gary's email, what type of facility should I go to for SARS-CoV vaccination? I'm concerned that I may have an undesired reaction. Would a vaccine like the AstraZeneca have any different risk level of side effects? My wife has a weakened immune system. Is there a diagnostic test she can take after vaccination to assess how good of a response she has? Well, I'm going to deal with Gary first. Gary, the allergic guy, who obviously has what we call a Th2-type immune system, or atopy, if you want to talk like an allergist. And this means that his mast cells, which carry histamine and bradykinin and a bunch of other compounds, are on a hair trigger. And when he encounters a substance that he's sensitized to, they break open, spit out a bunch of compounds, and these compounds cause, first of all, vascular leakage. Well, vascular leakage causes hives. It causes swelling of the face, mouth, and tongue, sometimes critical swelling of the airway. Asthma can be a result, and wheezing. And he's got everything. He's got the full Monty of reactions. And we know that there have been some cases of people having anaphylactic reactions. I really don't like the fact that he had a reaction to his flu shot. And the things we don't know about Gary are how old is he and what are his risks. So I'm going to assume that Gary is above 65. Maybe he's younger and has obesity or hypertension or diabetes. And so his risk of bad COVID is high enough for him to think about moving forward with vaccination, even though he's nervous about allergies. The first bit of advice I would give to a patient who asked me this question would be Benadryl. Preloading with Benadryl that's an antihistamine. I would get a driver and take enough of it to make you drowsy, maybe 25 to 50 milligrams, depending on how big you are. And Benadryl will tend to stabilize those mast cells. Another thing that helps calm things down, and you could preload with this if you can get it, is quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N. This also stabilizes the mast cells. And if you are preloading with these compounds, Benadryl you could take just hours before. The quercetin you probably want to take for about a week before you get your shot, so start now. Following up, you'll want to go to a facility that has doctors and that is certified by the state to give these vaccines. All of the certification and all of the training, the stuff I was complaining about at the top of the show, is making sure that we all know how to do this right. All the facilities are going to have epinephrine ready. My plan is to have it drawn up in syringes so that I can just give people a shot if they start to have an allergic reaction. My personal plan, if I am allowed to go forward with it, is to have an assistant who's going the rounds, keep people for 15 to 30 minutes, when right now it's 15 minutes, but we may get, the rules are changing, but for however long we keep people, I'd say 15 minutes is about right for an anaphylactic reaction, you're ready to give them medical treatment should they have a reaction. In general, that epinephrine shock works great. The problem is it wears off and you might have to give another one. So you want to be prepared for dealing with that. If you don't have an EpiPen, Gary, I would certainly get your primary care doctor to prescribe one for you. And based on your symptoms, I bet you already have one. Anyway, make sure that it's not expired. And all of the facilities that are giving out vaccine, even the mass vaccination clinics, are going to be prepared to deal with it. If you have a primary care doctor or a medical home, inquire with them where they stand in this process, and it would be nice to inquire in a way that doesn't tie up their phone. You also asked, would a vaccine like the AstraZeneca have a different risk level of side effects? And unfortunately, I'm inclined to say probably not. Now, of course, no one's done a head-to-head trial and, you know, all that scientific disclaimer stuff. But what people generally react to is not going to be the messenger RNA to the COVID. It's going to be one of the preservatives or the other compounds, basically soaps and detergents, which are used to make the vaccine irritating. That's why I had such a sore arm last week after my booster. It's an irritant, and that irritation is good because it wakes up the immune system like a fire alarm, gets it out of bed and sends it out looking for where's the fire. And of course, it finds this foreign compound and it goes, here's that fire, you know, bring out that adaptive immune system and let's get ourselves set up for it. That's going to be in all of the vaccines. There may be slight differences in which ones. I don't really think you can game this. You have to pre-medicate, make sure you inform the facility that you do have a history of allergic reactions. They should be asking you, because they'll take extra special care to keep you for longer and observe you, maybe have you wait somewhere where someone's keeping an eye on you. Now, with respect to your question about your wife who has a weakened immune system, the weaker your immune system, the less likely you are to have a vigorous response. And so this is also true for people who are on immunosuppressive drugs. Many of the monoclonals for rheumatoid arthritis or psoriasis or other diseases will have that effect. And if it is if you're on one of those agents and it's possible to stop it, check out what the half-life is, and that you can find in the PDR package insert. So drug name package insert will generally turn up a PDF. And you want to know how long that lasts in the system. Half-life is how long is it before half of the drug is gone, and you want to basically give it 5 half-lives if you can. That's if you're on a drug. If you just have a weakened immune system, you're going to want to be sure that you get the shot on the cycle that you're supposed to, and I would wait about 30 days after your second shot, and we have a study looking at titers from COVID infection, and another one we'll talk about a little later in the program about titers from the Moderna vaccine. But basically, at about the 30-day mark, you can see whether or not your antibody levels match up to the antibody levels from the studies that were deemed to be sufficient to protect against the disease. Now, all of that data is out there. It's a little complicated to find. You could certainly get some help from a medical librarian if you can possibly find one, but the best strategy would be to look at PubMed, which is a scientific publication clearinghouse run by the U.S. government, and look for the name of the vaccine. Antibody response duration would be a great search. You'll find studies. You can see what the numbers were, the antibody levels that were achieved, and then you can compare that to your score when you get your 30-day post-vaccination antibody test. The clock is ticking for me. I plan to get one of these antibody tests in about 3 weeks, which will give me a sense for whether I had a good take. And while this is not being recommended as best practices for the general population, I'm curious. And from the standpoint of someone who has an immune impairment, it would make a great deal of sense to just spring for the test. It's about $150, probably won't be covered under your insurance company, but, you know, it's worth it, especially in that circumstance. So that's my advice to Gary. A couple of science-y articles. The first one, a study that just came out about a week ago, looking at the antibodies at 6 months post-infection from COVID and what's going on, how good are the responses, and what happens with that T-cell immunity. This is a study that had 188 individuals with COVID-19, and they had asymptomatic, mild, moderate, and severe cases. The majority were from California and New York. Most of them, of course, had a mild case, not requiring hospitalization. 93 were never hospitalized. 7 of the subjects were. A couple of them needed ICU care. And this was pretty much the standard distribution that we're seeing of severity. They had a good age range, and they had quite a few patients who were older. So we'll talk about the age breakdown on this one in a little while. But in studying serial blood samples taken multiple times during convalescent and acute, they learned some things that we already thought we knew. And essentially, your initial reaction to COVID isn't related to antibody. It's related to T cells. And that T cell response, specifically the balance between the CD4 and the CD8 cells, is extremely important for that initial response. Then the innate immunity, which is the antibody-related, comes on board. Neutralizing antibodies we'll discuss those a little bit later in the program, but neutralizing antibodies do come on board, but they don't really do much initially. They keep you from getting reinfected. And there have been some interesting studies done in primates showing that passive transfer of neutralizing antibodies. What's that mean? Well, basically infect a chimpanzee or a macaque monkey, infect them with SARS-CoV-2, wait until they're better from their illness, take out some blood, separate out the antibodies, and then give it to another monkey before you infect them. And if you give them the neutralizing antibody ahead of time, it's very good at preventing the respiratory tract infection and symptomatic disease in the animal models. In humans, passive transfer of neutralizing antibody, the so-called convalescent antibody, has really not been as effective as we'd like. A lot of it probably relates to timing. If this is going to work, you're trying to basically mimic the process of already being immune. If you were already immune, the minute the virus got into you, you'd start attacking it. So you basically need to get people probably a couple of days into the illness to get the best benefit from convalescent titer. And obviously, that's tricky to pull off. The protective immunity lasts for a long time. The vast number of individuals showed that the IgG levels achieved were greater at 5 months than they were at 30 days. And of course, the study has only gone out 6 months. But what they don't see is a decline in that antibody. They do see, however, a drop in the number of COVID-specific T cells. So those guys come out early and do a handoff to the antibodies, and presumably in a re-exposure would be called back out of retirement to help fight the disease. So this is all very well, but we're talking about people who actually had COVID. It is, however, reassuring. And the fact that there wasn't a great variation over age, there were lower levels in older people, but not to the level that we would expect them not to be resistant. So I think there are very interesting question what's going on in those people who do get reinfected and what kept them from having a more durable antibody response. But I don't think anyone has any real sense of that in those individuals. Now, this study looked at the Moderna vaccine. The initial study that this group published was 57 days. Now they give us a follow-up study. This is an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, January 7th issue. It's a letter to the editor. Now we're looking at 120 days after the first vaccine and 90 days after the second vaccine in 34 healthy participants. They were 18 to 55, 56 to 70, or older than 71. And they show the tables. They got great levels of antibody after the booster examination. They got great levels of neutralizing antibody. And I will add that they actually got higher levels, substantially higher levels of neutralizing antibody than the people who actually got COVID did, which I found rather interesting. And I think it may have something to do with that sore arm, the inflammatory reaction. In any event, the natural antibody longevity compared from infection, compared with the vaccine, did not seem to be adverse in favor of natural infection. In fact, it tended to favor the vaccine. Now, this is very preliminary stuff by people at a bunch of institutions. The lead author is Alicia Widge, W-I-D-G-E. If you searched January 7th, New England Journal of Medicine, Widge, you could probably find the article online. And if you're interested in the deep numbers, feel free to give it a look. There's an issue that's emerged that I just wanted to address briefly, and that is related to the monoclonal antibodies. So one of the things, we have the Regeneron, and we have another product called Bimlanivimab. And these are approved for the treatment of non-hospitalized adults and children. People who are not going into the hospital, people who are presenting early. And the sicker people are, especially if they're sick enough to be hospitalized, the effect of these antibodies basically disappears. And so they're really good for people who are at high risk, but who aren't really sick just yet. Now, it's possible that giving the antibody later in the course of the development of the handoff, as I said, so those T cells that come riding to the rescue, there's reason to wonder whether or not giving the antibody a little later in the disease might actually slow down the T cell response by, well, effectively kind of hiding or screening the virus from the T cells and not letting it see the tissues that are infected as readily. This is not clear. This is me being hypothetical, and it's something that could be studied, but I don't have the budget. But I thought I'd tell you about these antibody products, which are monoclonal antibodies, because they are being used in our community. I spoke with one of the pharmacists at Dominican last night because a patient asked me about whether these were available. Apparently, her son got sick in New York, and they were not made available to him. I'm not sure about the timing of that. What I was informed was that these are available at our local hospital, and I'm presuming both of them, that they are targeting, and I'm going to give you some of the conditions. They're pretty much the same for both diseases. But if you have these things, and you think you've got COVID, or you test positive on one of those antibody tests, you might want to go in and ask for the monoclonal treatments, because they are substantially helping people not get less sick. getting less sick from COVID is, of course, a really good thing. So who's eligible? People who have a BMI of greater than 35. You can calculate that. It's basically your weight and height into an algorithm. Chronic kidney disease, diabetes mellitus, immunosuppressive disease, or currently receiving immunosuppressive treatment. You can also get it if you're older than 65 and you've got COVID, or if you're older than 55 and have either cardiovascular disease, like a history of a stent or a heart attack, hypertension, or chronic respiratory disease of any kind. You can also get it
if you are 75 years old.
And if you're 12 to 17 and you have sickle cell, congenital or acquired heart disease, neurodevelopment disorders like cerebral palsy, or if you have a trach or a feeding tube or other types of assistive medical-related technologies, or if you have asthma that's bad enough to require daily medication for control. So as you can see, that's a pretty broad spectrum of individuals, probably encompassing, I would guess, something around 30% or more of our population. The Regeneron, which we all got to hear about when our fearless leader got COVID, and got this, I might add, very early when it could do him some good, it's pretty much the same rules. Now, the way you access it is to show up in the emergency room of your hospital and your case is assessed. Then they would reach out to the infectious disease doctor. If I have someone who fits these criteria, my protocol would be to contact the ER, let them know that I'm sending someone over, give their name, let them be assessed for severity, and the ER doctor will reach out to the infectious disease doctor on call, who will make the call based on, I presume, do you meet the criteria, and how sick are you? Do we have enough supply to treat everyone at the moment? I'm not sure, but I was assured by the pharmacist that there are decent supplies of both of these agents in stock at the moment. Another bit of good information that I'm sure you'll be pleased to hear is that we're in the middle of a lull locally, and we don't have a full ICU anymore. We're back to all of the overflow beds have been closed down, and we're hoping, I am so hoping, but it's kind of a hope against hope, folks, because we're just about due for the Christmas rush, okay? 3 weeks from all that Christmas travel is when we can expect our numbers to start rising again. And in the hospital, and the people requiring hospitalization is thought to be likely to inflect sometime in the next week as the Christmas partiers come home to roost. And of course, we're going to get another bump with New Year's. And so realistically, if we're lucky and everybody behaves themselves, the end of January, we may start to see the hospital rates drop and start to continue to drop. That would be lovely. Who knows if we're actually going to see that? But at least it's nice to it's nice to be in a lull, but it's probably the eye of the storm. So I want to take a moment and just talk briefly about vaccination in general, because I think it's important. We're all so freaked out about being damaged by the vaccine, but we're not paying attention to the risk of COVID. If you go to our public health department site and you look at the public information, there's a thing called case positivity rate and another thing which is cases per 100,000. And you can see that we're in pretty bad shape locally. Most of the state's in pretty bad shape, but actually Santa Cruz is crossing lines. You know, on a growth curve, if you're growing too fast, that's what crossing lines means. When we're doing pediatrics, you might remember with your baby, the doctor pulls out a curve and sees where they are in the growth chart. And as long as they're following their established curve, we're happy. If they start crossing lines, and we worry. We worry they're either going to get too fat or that they're sick and they're losing weight for a reason. So crossing lines, no bueno. There is an entity called the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. It started in about 1988, and it was established by federal law as the place where claims of harm from vaccines must be filed and evaluated. It currently covers 15 childhood vaccines and the seasonal flu shot. And, of course, they keep data. So over three decades, the program has compensated about 6,000 people for harm they claimed was caused by viruses. About 70% of those have been settlements where there was harm and there was timing, but about 70% of them you really couldn't prove that the vaccine was at fault, but it was a bystander event and they just settled. Many of the recent programs have been payouts in the last few years have been related to those flu shots, because if you don't get the flu shot into the right spot and you shoot it into a tendon, that person's going to have painful arm, they're going to need physical therapy sometimes, they're going to have a tort case, a case for an injury. A very, very, very small number of deaths, and a total number amount of compensation. I found this was different, was interesting. It was $14 billion in compensation, and a very and over 30 years, 520 death claims. And almost half of those were from bad reaction to the old pertussis whole cell vaccine, which has not been around for about 20 years. So we know that measles is very contagious. We keep talking about R-naught, you know, an R-naught of like 1.5 for the newest, most aggressive COVID strain that's coming out of was identified by the United Kingdom, but is everywhere. Well, how does an R-naught of 12 sounds to you? That's the typical R-naught for measles. So it's a much more contagious disease. And about 1 in 4 people who get measles are likely to be hospitalized. And it's higher for adults. About 1 in every 1,000 people who get it actually die. For the harm claims, just to put it in perspective, because I think we need to, there were about 2 claims of injury for every 1 million doses distributed in the U.S. from 2006 through 2017, which is a pretty darn good track record, actually. It's supposed to be pretty easy to file a petition. I've heard unfairly demonizing this vaccine compensation plan, talking about how hard it is to make a claim, but actually it often pays for the lawyer fees, and that's even if the claim is not compensated. And they make it easy to file a petition. It takes a long time to get through the process, but yeah, right. So what was I complaining about at the top of the show? There's really no limit to what it'll pay for medical expenses. And there were 2 awards over the last 20 years for claims involving children that went into the multi-million, into double million digits, 30 million, 32 million, and 38 million. So they say that the vaccine is guilty until proven innocent, and it has a list of injuries and conditions that could be caused by vaccine. Some of those include bowel obstruction in children because the lymph nodes swell in the gut and their intestines block, and brain inflammation, which is, by the way, what the pertussis vaccine, the whole cell pertussis, caused in 1 out of every 50,000 kids who were vaccinated. But when it happened, it could cause death or mental retardation. So we recently moved, well, not so recently, 20 years ago, to a acellular pertussis vaccine, which is great until we figured out it doesn't work nearly as well as the whole cell version. So if you've had a grandchild in the last few years, you've had to get a vaccination because it wears off so quickly. In fact, we think it wears off after about 4 years. So if you will have had to do that, your daughter or your son will have told you you can't hold your grandchild until you've been vaccinated. And I'm not arguing against that, but I do remember the old vaccine and how effective it was. But maybe now, with this new technology, once it gets validated and we get some confidence in it, in an a decade, then maybe we'll be able to build ourselves a better pertussis vaccine. And I really think that I have to come down against the vaccine anti-vax thing as hard as I possibly can right now. This is not about politics. This is about people's lives, and the evidence for harm from this vaccine at this point, at least the two mRNA vaccines and the AstraZeneca, because we've got data from Great Britain on that that goes back around the same amount of time. These are what they are. They are vaccines. They have a rate of complication. It is not high. They are protecting you from a very, very serious disease and protecting others. So I really do want to get in people's face and ask them to look at the numbers. It's creepy to have something injected into you, but it's a lot creepier to be intubated in an intensive care unit fighting for your life. All right, off of the soapbox now. Let's go to another email. Next email is from David in Santa Cruz. I have a friend which has had two stents installed for 90% blockages. This was a surprise given his activity level and fitness and is probably a wake-up call for me. In an upcoming podcast, could you do a segment on atherosclerosis prevention, reversal, long-term prognosis as the lesions can usually continue to develop? And could you comment on supplementations such as marine pine bark and Centella asiatica? Not only am I interested, but I would like to share with him as he seems to be getting conservative care from Kaiser, while they talk about lifestyle and diet changes, it doesn't really seem to be the forefront. All right, so your friend's got two stents with lots of blockages, and we don't have any additional information. So I'm going to just talk about the variability of this disease and all of the factors that contribute. And a lot of it's genetic, and a lot of it's behavioral. So let's start with the genetic, which you can do some things about. Some people are programmed to make a lot of lipids. Some people are programmed to develop type 2 diabetes. The probably worst bit of genetic inheritance that you can get from the standpoint of atherosclerosis is genes for diabetes, because if you are eating a standard American diet, by the time you hit 50 or 60, you're likely to be insulin resistant. And insulin resistance causes inflammation. And we've always associated cholesterol with heart disease, you know, and then we subdivided into good cholesterol and bad cholesterol, and that's legitimate, but it's really not correct. Legitimate, but not correct, because cholesterol does not equal heart disease. Cholesterol plus inflammation, and especially small, dense cholesterol particles called LDL plus inflammation, is what really causes heart disease. Now, reversal, that's tricky. And really, reversal of the plaque is kind of not going to happen in a clinically meaningful way. There have been studies that I saw 15, 20 years ago where they put people on really high dose statin, drove their total cholesterol down to like 70. And over the course of a couple of years, they got about a half of a percentage reduction in the plaque. They also made the patients fairly sick, by the way, because you need cholesterol for a lot of things, like replacing your body tissues as they wear out and need to be replaced. Not to mention sex hormones and cortisol. So, yeah, you need some cholesterol. So reversing the plaque is not so important as making the plaque calm down, getting rid of the inflammation, and stabilizing the plaque. Stabilized plaque may cause angina with exercise or peripheral artery disease, which is claudication or muscle pain with activity, but it's not going to break and give you a blood clot. And in the heart, if you stabilize the plaque by using anti-inflammatory therapy, you see almost immediately an improvement in event rate. And I think the best study that showed this was one also probably 25 years ago, which looked at event rates in a large cohort after starting on a statin. It was a fairly high-dose statin, but they start on a statin, and within a month, the event rates start to separate between the statin group and the placebo group. Yes, their cholesterol came down, but it takes years for cholesterol to build into a plaque, and the plaques didn't shrink a bit, yet they stabilized because the inflammation was removed. They calmed down and were less likely to break open and thus trigger a blood clot in a coronary artery. Long-term prognosis, if you've got 90% blockages and you get stents in them, your long-term prognosis is pretty good. The main thing is not to get any more 90% blockages. And I won't be able to go too much into where people get blockages, but it's often at bends or forks in the arteries. And if a person has high blood pressure, they're going to get more plaque at the bends and forks in their arteries than if they don't. Heredity is important, fitness is important, but diet and insulin resistance and what the natural tendencies you inherited are also important. So we do know how to treat this. And you mentioned you wanted to hear about supplementation. I'm very strong advocate of using antioxidant therapy and anti-inflammatory therapy. And my go-to anti-inflammatory is omega-3 fatty acids or fish oil, because there are studies comparing high-dose fish oil to Lipitor showing that you get about the same benefit with 10 milligrams of atorvastatin and 2,000 milligrams of DHA plus EPA, which are two of the subcomponents of fish oil, and they're also found in krill oil. A diet that is low in sugar and low in starch therefore lowers your insulin and lowers your inflammation, and, by the way, it's the starch that raises your cholesterol, that in your natural biological settings. Eating fat does not raise your cholesterol very much, although it can be problematic, as saturated fat is, highly inflammatory, which we don't want. Now, the story about the pycnogenol, the marine pine bark, which is pycnogenol, or and Centella asiatica, these are two herbal components. I was very impressed with some articles I found when I searched for those. One article here showed that if people who were 46 to 60, who had 50 to 60% plaques in the femoral artery, got education, exercise, diet, and lifestyle changes, and they also got pycnogenol, or pycnogenol plus this Centella asiatica, and they were followed for 4 years. And what they measured there was, how fast did they get worse? Did they get worse more slowly with the antioxidants? And they also measured oxidative stress and showed that, yes, the people who got the antioxidants had lower markers for oxidative stress. They were better off, and the combination was better than the pycnogenol alone. So I like the one about hospital admission, 16% over 4 years in subjects versus 8.9%. In the placebo group versus 8.9 using pycnogenol. Also, the occurrence of heart attacks was significantly lower, P of 0.05, so decent. TIAs, transient ischemic attacks, were less frequent. The combination, again, doing better. And angina, which is to say chest pain related to activity, was 6% in the control group and 3% in the treatment group. So this it does appear to have a substantial benefit. And the mechanism, well, what's the mechanism? Well, the mechanism is that this pycnogenol is directly anti-inflammatory, and it also, by reducing inflammation through the NF-kappa-B pathway, something you may be familiar with, as it was talked about quite a lot in the spring in reference to COVID. This is the pathway that basically starts the avalanche that eventually leads to the COVID storm, the cytokine storm. If you give this compound, you don't get as much activation of this inflammatory pathway. And what they did was they wanted to see, well, is it, can we prove it? And they gave essentially a anti-toll-like receptor for antibody to block the binding of what they thought was the binding site. And when they blocked the binding site, they didn't get any clinical benefit from the pycnogenol. So pretty strong, good data suggesting that those compounds aren't bad. I have also seen pycnogenol used in combination with serrapeptidase. I saw a statistically significant study that showed that that prevented blood clots in your legs while flying in people who were prone to that. We've come to the end of the hour. I need to say goodbye. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.